I'd like to begin tonight's talk with a short teaching from Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, who was one of the great Dzogchen masters of the last century. He said, "The idea of an enduring self has kept you wandering helplessly in realms of samsara for countless past lifetimes. The idea of an enduring self is the very thing that now prevents you from liberating yourself and others from conditioned existence. If you could simply let go of that one thought of I, you would find it easy to be free and to free others too." So tonight I'd like to just share with you some of the kind of explorations and reflections that I've had on my own retreats during these last few years. Even after practicing for so many years, but as one continues with the practice, the Dharma is so vast, and we're always just at the forward edge of what we understand. And through reflections, through readings, through different books, and the application of this in my own practice and in our practice, very often we just get a new slant, a new perspective on the very basic teachings. One framework of understanding how the path unfolds, which I appreciate a lot, was the framework expressed by an 11th century Korean Zen master. His name was Shinul. And he talked about the path as sudden awakening, gradual cultivation. So it kind of just reverses how we often think of it. As first we gradually cultivate and then we have an awakening. He highlighted the experiences that we have all along the way on different levels. Moments of sudden awakening to some aspect of the Dharma. And then those insights, those awakenings, need to be cultivated. One moment of realization is generally not enough. We have them, they're genuine, and we learn something, but then they need to be cultivated. So tonight I just want to share some of the sudden awakenings and gradual cultivations, particularly from these last few years. Every year generally I do a self-retreat of a month or 2 months, and it really helps to keep the practice alive and interesting. It's a continual exploration. So this is just a very simple reflection that came to me. And it came after visiting a friend who was going through a serious illness. And she lived quite a distance away. I don't see her that often, although we're very old friends. Now when I came home and was on retreat, I just reflected that, given what she was going through and her life, my stories probably played a very little part of her life and her experience. Maybe she thought of me occasionally, but mostly I'm sure I was not a central being in her unfolding. And then I thought, well, that's even more true for 7.2 billion people who are not even remotely aware of my stories, even that I exist. I don't know, there's just something about that weakened the hold of the story, the dramas that we create for ourselves in our own lives, we take them to be so central to the workings of the universe. And this provides just a slightly different perspective. You know, we begin to see, yeah, these are happening and they may be relatively important in terms of what we're going through, but can we have a little more space around our own stories, our own dramas? I came across a teaching by famous Burmese master. His name is Ledi Sayadaw, and that's L-E-D-I, not L-A-D-Y. Ledi Sayadaw. And he was a prolific writer. You know, he wrote many treatises on Buddhism and teachings, and he was a very enlightened master. He was a great practitioner. And I came across this one teaching where he just listed, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 expressions of wrong view. And when I read down the list, I realized that each one of them was expressive of how most of us live. And so what was the list? It was very simple. So the list of wrong view. I'm angry, I'm happy, I'm sad, I'm excited, I'm depressed, I'm bored. I'm rushing, I'm going here, I'm going there. It wasn't the states that were wrong view. It was the I am. Right? Every time we're in our experience with this sense of I am, we're already in wrong view. We're already not seeing clearly. So when I read that, it was a little startling, you know, to see how this is the common way that we experience things. So upon reflecting a bit, I came up with a formulation which I call from am to is. To really change our perspective of things, to go from seeing things through the filter of I am to viewing our experience through the formulation there is. And so how could we apply this, you know, and explore it in our practice, which I did on retreat? I started watching for that sense of I am arising in the course of a day. And of course, it can arise a lot. It can arise through all the various physical activities that we're engaged in. I'm walking, I'm going, I'm seeing, I'm eating. I'm sitting, I'm standing, I'm rushing. So just to watch in the course of the day in the physical activities, keep an eye out just for the felt sense of I'm doing this and see what that feels like. We can begin to notice the I am in terms of various emotions like Ledi Sayadaw pointed out, I'm angry, I'm happy, I'm sad. So watch how you language your experience to yourself during the course of the day as you're feeling different emotions. Now see if the initial way we relate is through this filter of I'm feeling this. We can watch for the I am in different mental activities. You know, I'm thinking, I'm planning, I'm judging, I'm commenting, I'm enjoying. Even, and this maybe something you've played with just in the last day or two, a very subtle place of I am-ing is in the identification we have with intention. You know, I'm intending. So, I've mentioned this in a couple of the groups. Usually with intention, you know, we may become aware of it before an action as an impulse that initiates an action. But actually the intention is happening all through the action. So you're walking, and it's not an intention simply that begins us walking. Intention or volition is happening throughout each step. And if the intention stopped, the foot would stop mid-step. So it's sort of like an electric current, you know, running the light. If we pull out the plug, the light goes out. On retreat, this was just a year or two ago, I remembered this about how intention, volition, is an ongoing process, moment to moment, and it's what keeps things moving. So it just came to mind, I remembered that, and I was kind of watching it in the walking meditation. And it began to feel like there was a little intention motor, you know, keeping things going, keeping the walking going. And it almost felt like that. I'm exaggerating a bit, but it was almost like that, you know, that when I turned my attention to the intentions, to the flow of intentions that was keeping things going, what was interesting about that was first I saw how very rarely did I pay attention to that. Usually I might notice the intention which started the action, but then forget all about the intentions that were keeping it going. And because I wasn't paying attention to it, that's the very place where there was a strong sense of I am. You know, well, I'm the one walking. But actually, it's just volition, keeping the movement going. And it became very interesting to see the impersonality, the non-self, the non-I of volition. You know, the stream of volitions that keep us moving through the day. So this is quite a subtle place of looking at I am. In this exploration of going from am to is, from I am to there is, first we want to become conscious of that feeling, I'm doing this, I'm going here, I'm thinking this, and then just change the language. There is walking. There is thinking. There is anger. There is happiness. There is whatever the experience is manifesting. And then to notice, and this can be noticed quite clearly, how it feels when we're in the I am state. I'm doing this. I'm going here. I'm rushing. How does that feel? And then how does it feel when we change it to there is going, there is thinking, there is planning, there is whatever? In the I am-ness, there's a contraction. We feel there's a felt sense of being enclosed. And my experience was that as soon as I went from am to is, from I am to there is, the heart relaxed, the heart opened. It's as if everything settled into a place of spaciousness because we freed ourselves from the contraction of self, of I. So again, all of this was just, it was an exploration. You know, I became interested in seeing and understanding. If you think that, you know, this may sound interesting, but is not that important, I just want to read a couple of comments of the Buddha with regard to this. He said, by rightly understanding I am, one makes an end of suffering. The eradication of I am is the attainment of nibbana here and now. It might be worth taking a look. This is not a small matter. Right? And we can investigate this, and you can investigate it in your own way. I'm just kind of sharing with you how my mind began to take a look at this sense of amness, I am, and the possibility of being free of it. So we also create a strong sense of self in our attachment to our views and opinions about things. And what's so amazing is that we can have strong attachments and opinions regarding things we know nothing about. But it does not stop us from holding very strongly to a view. So I'll share with you one story that this actually is not from recent times. This goes back many years. I was first beginning to teach at Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado. This was 1974, 75. And one of the great Tibetan masters was coming to teach and to give a talk. His name was Dujum Rinpoche. And he was really one of the great Tibetan masters. You know, a highly realized being. And the poster for the talk he was given said, Dujum Rinpoche, incarnation of Sariputra. Now, Sariputra was the chief disciple of the Buddha, second only to the Buddha in his wisdom. For the last 20 years, I had been immersed in Theravada Burmese Buddhism. And in these teachings, when you're fully enlightened, you don't come back. Right? Rebirth has come to an end. So I saw this poster, Dujum Rinpoche, incarnation of Sariputra. And my mind kind of went on tilt. It just seemed impossible. You know, Sariputra didn't come back. On the one hand. On the other hand, this was a great enlightened Tibetan master. And in that moment, there was like a moment of realization that actually, I had no idea whether he was the incarnation of Sariputra or not. All I knew is the Burmese said this, the Tibetans said this. I didn't know. Most importantly, I realized I didn't have to have an opinion about it. It was hugely freeing to realize there's so much we don't know, and that it's much freer to rest in the not knowing than to get attached to some view about something we really don't have the experience of. And this is where, you know, one of my favorite mantras, which I think I've probably shared with you over these last days, it's been really helpful for me, you know, ever since I realized, you know, how much I and we don't know. So the mantra is, who knows? Is Stuja Rinpoche the incarnation of Sariputra? Who knows? And what was so interesting was that this who knows is not the who knows of confusion. It's the who knows of openness. It's like, well, who knows? You know, maybe someday as our meditation deepens or our understanding grows, maybe one day we will know. But we don't have to rush that, you know, and lay claim to an opinion, to a view. Just this would be the resolution of so many interpersonal conflicts. You know, how much is because we're attached to a particular view of things? So another area of insight that happened actually just on this last retreat, in January. And it had to do with understanding the relationship of metta and vipassana. You know, and in our retreats, as you know, we often practice both. And many times questions arise, well, how do they fit together? Because in metta, we're dealing with the concept of beings, of self and other and, you know, benefactor and relationship of one being to another. And so how does that fit in with the notion of no self, that there's no one there? Where's the connection? Well, we can understand the connection in two ways. We can understand the connection in terms of the teachings on two levels of truth. You know, there's a level of relative truth, conventional truth, and then a level of more ultimate truth. So the concept of being, of self, of other, this is true on the relative level. You know, we relate to one another, and so when we're doing metta practice, we're not thinking in terms of may your five aggregates experience pleasant Vedana. No, we're saying may you be happy. You know, it's very simple. It's the conventional reality, and we can and we do and we have to relate on that level. This is the level of our ordinary life. At the same time, we can understand that there is a more ultimate reality in which self and I is seen through. And so just as an example of this, you know, on the relative level, this is a glass, and we could describe it, we pour water into it, and we can drink from it. If we looked at this glass through a high-powered microscope, there would be no glass. The level of glass would disappear. We would be seeing an entirely different reality. And not only that, most of that reality would be empty space. So is one more true than the other? No, it's different levels of perception. And is one reality, is glass here, an emptiness, you know, and electrons and atoms over here? No, it's the same. They're unified, and yet we can perceive different levels of truth, different levels of reality, depending on what we're perceiving. So in just the same way, we can understand metta on the conventional level, you know, of self, of other, we send good feelings, and at the same time, know that on a more ultimate level, we realize the selfless nature of it all. Okay, so that's one way of understanding the relationship of metta and vipassana. There's another way. And this is what happened on this retreat, and it was really transformative, of seeing the power of metta to actually free the mind from the sense of self, from the prison of self. So this was a very interesting realization. So before the retreat started and for the months preceding, I had been involved in a rather large group dynamic that was extremely difficult. There was a lot of tension, a lot of conflict, a lot of views, a lot of opinions, and it had been something that had been going on and on and on. And I was right in the middle of this, and it was very painful. There was a lot of suffering involved. And so on retreat, I'd come into the retreat with all of this conflict, really bubbling strongly. And I was going over and over in my mind. It's like I became a great lawyer from my point of view. So I was just going on and on, going down the whole list of why I was right and my view was right and justifying it and, why didn't these other people see it that way and what's... But this was very intense. This was a highly charged emotional situation. And the mind was just repeating, going over and over and over and over. So it just so happens that during that retreat, I had come across a book and started reading it called Tattoos on the Heart. I don't know if you've read it or heard of it. Very amazing book. It's by a Jesuit priest named Gregory Boyle. And he lives and works in Los Angeles, right in the middle of the area where all the gang violence is happening. So he's working with these gangs of kids, just right in the middle of the most intense, lots of violence, lots of shooting, lots of killing. It's intense, intense situation. And he's amazing. It's written beautifully, and it really conveys both the sense of the violence and the conditions that caused it, and most importantly, the space that he was holding. So in the midst of all this, the space that he held, as kids were, when teenagers, young adults, all these drive-by shootings and innocent people getting killed and, terrible, terrible things. The space he held and manifest was expressed as love no matter what. That's how he was relating to everybody in this situation. Love no matter what. No matter what these kids were doing, whether they were the victims, whether they were the perpetrators, love no matter what. And of course, as a Jesuit, he was expressing it a lot, in God language. The kind of love that God would have. Love no matter what. And even though that's not the Buddhist language, it's not the language that I particularly resonate with, still in that context, in the way he expressed it, it became a doorway to actually letting the heart love no matter what. So then just by itself, that feeling was so beautifully expressed in the book, and sort of it entered me in the midst of my own conflict. And I actually couldn't start with love no matter what, but I had a slight addition to it. So as I was thinking all these thoughts about the conflict and all these people, what they were doing, and from my perspective, all the suffering that was being caused, and just going on and on and on. So I started out kind of just transforming that language a little bit. And especially kind of in walking meditation, but also in sitting, I would just repeat to myself, as my mind was going on and on, I would repeat to myself, endlessly forgiving, which is just another way of saying love no matter what. Endlessly forgiving. And then I'm on, but endlessly forgiving. You know, and the lawyer would come back in, and it was amazing. It was really amazing because the endlessly part didn't leave any back door. There was no room for the buts. And then from that, as I kind of settled, yeah, just endlessly, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what these people are doing. It doesn't matter what they're thinking. It doesn't matter what they've said. Endlessly forgiving. That was an easy move to that feeling of love no matter what. And it was amazing. It was really amazing what happened. From being embroiled in this situation for months and longer than that, you know, and caught up in a huge amount of suffering, fueled by that sense of self-righteousness, of being right, of feeling right, you know, that attachment to being right kept fueling all of that mental activity. But through that book and his example, love no matter what, it doesn't matter. The heart just opened and released from that imprisonment of self, of I, of being right. Love no matter what. That is a much freer place. It was like opening the door of the prison cell. You know, opening the door of that sense of self that I was justifying to myself. Well, I should feel this way because I'm right. And it was so powerful. You know, so all these people that I've been in conflict with, they were just in this field of love no matter what. And it was quite remarkable. Just the transformation in those moments. This really was not a process. It was just that insight into this possibility. And things still needed to be worked out and discussions needed to be happen. But that transformation of the heart, just from feeling the possibility of that space, really has remained. You know, see, that quality of love no matter what is so much more important, so much freer, so much more connected than being right. You know, so when we weigh the two, and when we look at it in our experience, it really can become a motivation for exploring that space. Okay. 7.2 billion people don't know I exist. That was a big help. From am to is, just watching for the I am-ness through the day, seeing where it pops up. And just in that moment, just read language. I'm angry, there is anger. I'm walking, there is walking. See the difference in your experience. When we're caught in conflict and justifying it to ourselves, can we find that space of endlessly forgiving? Love no matter what, no back door. It's so tremendously freeing. Another very interesting experience I had came from reading in the suttas, in the discourses, something which I've read many, many times. It's some images the Buddha used. And so I had read it, you know, over the years. I've come across it many times. But just recently I was on retreat and I read these words. And instead of just reading it as a description and thinking, oh, well, that sounds good, I started using the words as an instruction in practice. So these are the images the Buddha used to describe the five aggregates. You know, and if you remember, the five aggregates are the Buddha's analysis of this mind and body, of what constitutes what we call self. You know, the physical elements, the material elements, feeling, tone, vedana, perception, which is recognition, mental formations, which is everything that's happening in our minds, and consciousness, just that bare knowing faculty. And so these five aggregates, the Buddha's talking about a lot, you know, in almost every discourse. The Buddha's using these five aggregates as a way of understanding what we call self, what we call I and mine. So in this one discourse, the Buddha gave images for each of these aggregates. And so he said, you should consider the body as being a lump of foam. Now, do you know what that is? You know, on a river, you might, do you know what foam, like that bubbly, foamy, you know. So a lump of foam is just, you know, a bunch of foam. And then he said, so the body, see the body as a lump of foam. See feelings, vedana, feeling tones, as bubbles on a stream. See perception as a mirage. You know mirage? You know, when, if you're, yes. Yes. So it's perception as a mirage. All mental formations, he said, as a plantain tree. That's like a banana tree. You know, a banana tree has no core to it. You know, the trunk of a tree, you just peel it away. There's nothing at the center. So all the mental formations, all the emotions, thoughts, are centerless, like a banana tree. And he said, consciousness is like a magic show. Okay, so he used these images, and again, had read it many times. But then I thought, well, what if I actually use these images in my practice? You know, taking them as an instruction rather than as a description. It was really interesting. So I was just sitting and feeling the body and all of, you know, just the sensations of the body with that image of them being like a lump of foam. You know, there's no solidity there. It's just that. It's just a lump of foam. Something remarkable happened just in the moment of letting that image settle into the experience. I think most of you are probably familiar with the tendency in meditation to be with what's arising, but leaning into the next moment. We're with this in order for this, right? We're with the sensation in order for it to weaken. Or we're with a feeling in order for it to go away. Or there's very often, both in a, sometimes in a gross way, but sometimes in a very subtle way, just that slight leaning into the process, as if the next moment is going to bring the fulfillment that we're looking for. You know, it's not quite here, but we're with this breath in order to feel the next breath. I think I may have mentioned when we were talking about Utejaniya's suggestion of checking the attitude. One time when I was sitting and just feeling my breath, simple, just completely simple, didn't think there was much else going on. I simply asked the question in the mind, what's the attitude? Not even thinking there was an attitude. Simply by asking the question, what's the attitude? I could feel an energetic relaxation back from a wanting that I didn't even know was there. I was just feeling the breath, but in that moment of what's the attitude, kind of drop back, I realized that I was with the breath, just with this very subtle wanting more concentration, or more calm, or something. Just that slight leaning. Okay, so this is, you might pay attention, you know, when you're sitting, when you're walking, you're lifting in order to move forward. We're moving forward in order to step. So you might, you know, really look at that in your practice. So I'm sitting, body is a lump of foam, and I really kind of drop into that, and the immediate effect, just in the moment of having that image represent my experience, it totally cut that leaning into the next moment. Because there was the clear realization, yes, the body, that's all it is. It's a lump of foam, just these sensations. And all it is going to be in the next moment is a lump of foam. And in the moment after that, it's going to be a lump of foam. And it will never be anything else but a lump of foam. And so just with that image, it cut that sense of, oh, I'm with these sensations in order for them to become these sensations. Do you follow the cutting that forward leaning just through this image? So you might experiment to see feeling tone, you know, as bubbles on a stream. Each one of those sensations that's a lump of foam, each one we're experiencing is either pleasant or unpleasant. But when we're seeing it all as a lump of foam, the feeling tones themselves are just like bubbles. There's nothing much there. And so not much to react to in terms of grasping or aversion. When we're seeing that momentariness like bubbles on a stream. Perception is a mirage. This is very interesting. You know, we perceive the world as if the world we perceive is really there. You know, we're living in the view and relating with a very pretty solid fixed view through our perceptions of what's out there. You know, the mountains and the trees and other people and the buildings and just our whole world. Just imagine for a moment if our eyes were constructed in a different way. And I don't really know how an insect's eyes are constructed, but I imagine they're different. We would be seeing completely different things. Completely different. Which one is really out there? You know, what's the real reality? Oh, well, insects are just our reality. That's how it is. No, it's perception is like a mirage. We're seeing things conditioned by the way our sense organs are constructed. But because we don't consider this, and we're not particularly mindful of the act of perceiving and recognizing, we give a reality to it. It's kind of interesting and a little science fiction-y to realize that there is no one fixed way reality is. It's always perceived through the conditioned structure of the organ, the sense organs receiving the impressions. Isn't that a little... I like it. You know, it's like... Have you ever read Kurt Vonnegut? Or I don't know. But what it does, it doesn't mean that all of a sudden we, you know, are living in the matrix. But it does weaken our attachment, you know, to our particular perception, our particular view of things. The idea that things are so solid and this is the way they actually are. So just to get a little taste of this. This also is just experimenting with on retreat. I just made a very small shift in how I was noting. So in moving about, instead of noting seeing, I just started noting perceiving. So that's all, just that change of the word. It shifted my experience. So rather than go into what the shift in my experience was, I just suggest try it. No, maybe I will tell you about this. It's just when I was noting seeing, even though it was being much more mindful, you know, of what was being seen rather than being lost in all my concepts about what was being seen. But it's still in some way, just in some way, it was attributing a reality to what I was seeing, to the seeing, to the various objects being seen. So even though I was mindful, oh, you're seeing, you know, there was kind of a substantiality to what was being seen. When I started noting perceiving, somehow that reinforced this understanding of the constructed nature of our perceptions. You know, and it just settled the mind back a little more, a little freer of attachment to the object, to what was being seen. So again, all of these are just suggestions for you to play with and see, you know, do they have an impact in your practice? The next one was really powerful. This one I really suggest you practice with. Mental formations, emotions, thoughts as a banana tree. Just remembering the... Do you know the word pith? Pith is kind of the core of a tree. So in a banana tree, there's no pith. It's just, you just, you know, take the leaves apart of the trunk and there's nothing at the center. So to remind oneself that all of the emotions that we're feeling and all the thoughts and all the mental phenomena and all this big story and the drama of our lives that we're so caught up in, it's as pithless, as coreless as a banana tree, as a plantain tree. And just bringing that image into the moments of experiencing these mental formations, it's like it really helped, you can really just see how they dissolve instead of being so caught and so identified and thinking so much this is who I am and they're so solid and so me. You know, the image really helps to see the empty nature, what Fred was talking about last night. And consciousness as a magic show. And again, really with reference to Fred's talk, he expressed it beautifully. Consciousness itself arises out of conditions. You know, it's not something that's there in some solid, self-existing way. Given certain conditions, seeing consciousness arises. Given certain conditions, hearing consciousness arises. Or that image of the film, you know, when we're just lost in conventional reality, we go to the movies, we get lost in the story, we have all kinds of emotions. It's a magic show. You know, it's these frames of film moving very quickly. And when we see that, we see the empty nature. You know, what we thought was there in the way we thought it was there is not there. We can begin to see consciousness itself as this kind of magic show. Now again, just to remind you of the two levels of truth. As we begin to experience each of the aggregates in this way through these images, it's not that we lose the ability to relate on a conventional level. We still have the glass, we still pour water in it, we still drink from it, we still relate to one another as self and other. There's no problem with any of that. But we also see the deeper reality. We've realized the deeper reality, so that even as we're engaged on the conventional level, we are not so attached. We're not so clinging. And the less attachment, the less clinging, the less suffering. You know, the words said that the Buddha used just after his enlightenment, kind of his song of enlightenment, starts with the lines, "O house builder, you have been seen. You will build no house again." Okay, the house builder is the creation of this sense of self, the house of self, the house of Joseph. "Oh, house builder, you have been seen." We begin to understand how we're building this house over and over again. And at a certain point, maybe we'll be able to say, like the Buddha did, "Oh, house builder, you have now been seen. You will build no house again." But even if we don't build it for a few moments at a time, you know, we begin to see that possibility. So a big challenge for us is how to integrate these two levels. You know, the relative conventional level of understanding and use of language, of I and self and other, and all of that is fine. But how can we relate and play and work on the conventional level with this deeper understanding? So different teachers have expressed this in different ways. I want to read one. It's from a Tibetan teacher, Khonsho Gelshin. He said, "We are not denying or ignoring the label of I. We are just questioning whether it exists independently. The Buddha himself used conventional language when he said things like, 'When I was in such and such a place and I did such and such a thing.'" So the Buddha used this language, you know, and he related on this conventional level. But the self to which it refers does not really exist. That's why we are said to be confused. No matter how long we meditate, we will never see a self. We cherish ourselves so much that surely we should have seen it by now. But no one has seen a self-existent self. Grasping and cherishing that which does not exist is at the center of our suffering. So just a few other shorter pointings to this truth. There was a writer, I think he was either English or Irish, but he lived in Asia, and I think in Hong Kong. He wrote under the name Wei Wu Wei, and his books are wonderful, and he clearly had some, you know, deep realizations. He said, "Belief in a sense of self is like a dog barking up a tree that isn't there." So that's a lot of what we're doing. We're barking up this tree that's not there. So when we begin to get glimpses of this, we can stop barking. You know. So one other Tibetan teacher expressed it in a way that is really good. He said, it's not that you're not real. We all think we're real. And that's not wrong. But you think you're really real. You exaggerate it. So this is our practice. You know, it's, yes, we're real in just the ordinary way we're living our lives. But can we begin to see that we're not really real? And that's the dance, you know, and that's the work of our practice. And the fruit of our practice, the fruit of our realization of this emptiness of self, really allows us to open to a much bigger, freer space. A space that includes love no matter what. Because it's no longer self-referential. I'll just close with a teaching from Kala Rinpoche, who was another great master of the last century. He said, we live in illusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality. We are that reality. When we understand this, we see that we are nothing. And being nothing, we are everything. That is all. So that's the beauty of this whole path. The more we see the emptiness of self, the more we see that we are nothing in that sense. By being nothing, we are everything. That is all.